Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your his and hers horizontal mirrors of music news and criticism. I'm your host, Joe Coscarelli, filling in for John Caramonica. Those sounds, of course, are the Rolling Stones, Can't Get No Satisfaction. But we're not here to talk about the one-year anniversary of Old Cella. We are here to discuss Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine, a new biography by Joe Hagen, chronicling the life of Jan Wenner, who created Rolling Stone as a 20-something in San Francisco, California, 67. Here to discuss the book with me, I have the Daily Book critic from the New York Times, Dwight Gardner.
Nice to be here.
And Sydney Ember, the media reporter at the Times, who covers Rolling Stone as part of her beat.
Great to be here.
So Sydney and I worked together earlier this month on a story about how this book came together. If you know anything about it so far, you might know that Jan Wenner, the subject of the book, who worked closely with the author for 4 years on it, is very disappointed in how it turned out. He called it deeply flawed and tawdry in our story. We'll get a little bit into the backstory later. Dwight, you liked the book more than Jan, I think. It's fair to say.
He's really made a bad decision to come down on this book because A, it reads like a rocket. It's just a great biography. And B, you know, he comes off in his own way as kind of lovable in it. I mean, he's clearly a bully, a megalomaniac, and a crazy person. But he had great instincts. He had a great life. And, you come away from him with a really complicated portrait. And I don't think it's entirely negative at all.
In your review, you called it supple, confident, dispassionately reported, and deeply well-written. You said it plays like a crunching collection of singles, not a thumb-sucking double album, that it's a joy to read and feels built to last. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you think Joe Hagen's aim for a biography of this size is. I mean, this is the kind of minute detail I think that's like typically reserved for like a presidential biography, but it just so happens to have way more drugs and sex.
He's clearly reported the heck out of this book. I mean, it's just, there's so much gossip in it. We were talking earlier about this that you almost can't remember it all. I mean, it's just extraordinary about everyone. But the great thing about Hagen's writing in this book, I think, is that there are few biographers out there who have the capability to be a sort of critic and an intellectual the way Joe is, and to write about what Wenner meant to the society, both in the 60s and in the ensuing decades. And yet at the same time, this ability to work as clearly a great researcher and archivist to pull this material out. And clearly, he has a great way with people because the interviews he gets are extraordinary.
Right. And not just any interviews. Like these are
exactly,
these
with some major players.
Right. You get Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
You
have, people say extraordinary things to him, this guy. And so he has all the aspects you want, all the things you want a biographer coming together in telling this amazing story.
And why Jan? For people who didn't grow up obsessed with Rolling Stone, like I think many people did over the decades, myself included, in the 90s and 2000s, you get this sense that there are many generations of children of Rolling Stone. But Jan, he's famous and he's a media baron, but he's not exactly a household name. Like, what's the case you think Joe Hagen is making in this book for why Jan matters and why he's worth a 600-page book?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, why an editor, right? I think he puts it pretty well in the book. I think this is a line from Joe himself. He says, Wenner was the boy who bottled the counterculture. You know, he put it all together and exported it across the country. These things that were happening in San Francisco just spoke to so many sort of lonely people out there who felt these things happening, felt what was in the wind. But it took Rolling Stone finding its way to them on maybe a little newsstand in some grocery store to finally sort of realize what was happening and find out what to listen to, find out about politics, find out about sexuality, find out about drugs. Early subscriptions, I think, came with a roach clip. And then as the decades went on, he increasingly mirrored what was happening in the culture as we moved into the me decades in the 70s. And as Joe writes in another great line, how the me decade of the 70s became the me decades. I mean, it's just ever since then, we've lived in that kind of world. And his lifestyle mirrored that, and his magazine mirrored that.
And one of the points Hagen makes early on that then circles back at the end is that there's something similar about Jan Wenner and the president of the United States,
it's brutal.
Donald Trump.
It's brutal.
They're the same age. And he sort of draws this parallel between them, which is corroborated by, you know, staffers and longtime friends, employees of Jan Wenner. Like, did you feel like that was a reach in terms of the metaphor, the drawing of the line between the two? Or do you think that the book makes the case for that?
It's a bit of a reach, but it's a fascinating connection to make. I think Hagen makes the point that, you know, in a way, Wenner was this great giver over, this presenter of the celebrity culture. And the celebrity culture came to dominate everything, and Trump is the ultimate product of that culture. And that's the line he's drawing. And he does it pretty well, I think.
Yeah, there's a part at the end here where that connection between Trump is being made, and the things that Joe Hagen cites are the crude egotism, the neediness, the total devotion to celebrity and power. And then you have a staffer, Will Dana, saying, "When I hear Trump talking, this sounds like Jan. High-functioning narcissists can be incredibly effective people."
Yeah, the big difference, though, to give Wenner his due, someone in the book calls him one of the world's greatest spitball intellectuals. And that's what you want in an editor, really. You want someone who can pick up almost any topic and have opinions about it and know who to send off on it. And Wenner had that, this great ability to sort of feel what was in the wind and put the perfect writer on it and understand why stories mattered. And, you know, Trump, as far as I can tell, never had a cogent thought in his life, I mean, except to make money. And Wenner cared about everything. So the comparison only goes so far.
Right. And so, you know, obviously we've touched a little bit on this. You know, there's the Trump parallels. There's a lot of sex, a lot of drugs. Wenner's longtime sort of semi-closeted homosexuality is a big through line in this book, including, you know, his marriage to Jane Wenner, who funded Rolling Stone early on. You know, there's a lot of dirt about their marriage, about their children. But this is only like the tip of the iceberg in terms of things that one could possibly be mad about if they sat down and read this book about themselves. Sydney, maybe you can pull back and give us a little update on Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone and the world that this book sort of enters, and why someone like Jan might be in a particularly vulnerable position to take in all of this information about himself at a time like this.
Yeah, sure. So while this was all happening, while the book was being written, there, you know, the magazine industry was facing a pretty severe financial downturn. So there's definitely that undercurrent. At the same time, though, Rolling Stone had a very damaging article at the end of 2014 about a rape allegation at the University of Virginia, and that led to three lawsuits, you know, lots of financial damages that Rolling Stone had to pay, not to mention the big reputational hit that the magazine took. So already Rolling Stone and Wenner Media, Jan Wenner's company, was in a, you know, pretty diminished position. Over the last year, Jan and his son Gus have sold two of Wenner Media's titles, Us Weekly and Men's Journal, and they also sold a 49% stake in Rolling Stone last fall. So Jan no longer has this big media empire that he once had. And then we find out in the book that he fell playing tennis over the summer and broke his hip, and he had a heart attack and actually underwent triple bypass surgery. So, you know, Jan, who was once a towering figure, kind of has been laid low.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about why you think he agreed to this book. So obviously this was before this downturn in his empire that you described. But, you know, Rolling Stone was already maybe on the downswing. It didn't have the cachet that it used to. It's not as thick as it used to be as a magazine. Its place in the culture has been diminished probably over the last two decades or so. And, you know, something I think we found as we were reporting the story, which had been out there a little bit, was that Jan had previously tried to have two books written about him. And what they had in common was that he was going to have complete control over them, that he would be able to have veto power over what would be included and what wouldn't. Neither of those books came to fruition. And yet here we sit with this monster 600-page expose, which a lot of times is not kind to him. And I think a lot of people, when they hear that he's upset about it, wonder, well, what did he think he was getting into? So I guess I'm curious why you think he decided to sit for this now, you know, hundreds of hours of interviews we're talking. And then maybe you and I can talk a little bit about our time with Joe Hagen, the writer of the book, and how we came to this story of Jan disowning it.
Yeah, I think Jan has always sort of had a outsized maybe opinion of himself and of his magazine and of his place in sort of the magazine and in shaping the magazine. he saved letters, he saved postcards of himself from a very early age, so he always sort of thought of himself as someone who deserved a book, it seems like.
Right, and the book says flat out in the beginning he thought he was going to be important.
Exactly.
So he saved every scrap of paper.
Exactly. And I also think that Jan, you know, may not recognize or may not want others to see that the magazine is so diminished. He, you know, I wrote a story when they announced that the magazine was going up for sale, and he emailed me afterwards saying, you know, I got it wrong. The magazine still does hold a really big place in culture, and they, you know, have the sort of figures of today's music on the cover, which is something that a lot of people have criticized Rolling Stone for, of being sort of outdated and putting Bruce Springsteen on the cover and Bob Dylan on the cover,
right,
as opposed to
giving U2 the number one album of the year, in 2014, which is in the book. And Jan says, yeah, that was my call, like that he personally made that happen.
Everyone who read the magazine that year realized that was the last straw. I mean, the magazine is now dead in terms of a critical organ. You just knew it. I mean, I subscribe. I still get it. You know, I can honestly say that Rolling Stone changed my life. I started reading it in 1978 when I was 13. I stopped reading it, I mean, reading all the time anyway, in 83 when I went to college. But Rolling Stone, you didn't just find out about music, you find out about the forebears. You read about Van Morrison, you discover about Howlin' Wolf, and you go back and you find this stuff. And if you cared, you could get a whole, you could learn everything. I mean, they profiled writers like Ken Kesey and Robert Stone, and there was Hunter S. Thompson, and there's a whole countercultural world, Kerouac, Ginsberg. It just gave you everything in a way that no other one magazine did at that time.
And it seemed like that was the story, I think, if we had to imagine the story that Jan Wenner wanted to tell. He wanted to maybe be seen as the sort of wizard behind all of these moments, you know, gonzo journalism and the 60s as a brand, as a moment. You know, there's great stories in here of Altamont, where it's sort of the first time Wenner has to turn his back on the music that he loves, when he sort of blames the Stones for what happened at the concert. And, you know, you get a lot of these sort of tentpole generational moments through Kent State and Watergate and et cetera, all through the lens of Rolling Stone. But Sydney, when we talked to Joe Hagan, the author of the book, like, did you get the sense that he was as interested in that stuff as he was in the personal life of Jan Wenner?
I definitely got the sense that Joe wanted to explore all facets of Jan. He was interested in Rolling Stone, but he was more interested in Jan as the person behind this magazine. And he wasn't so interested in talking about Rolling Stone as this defining magazine. Of course, that's in the book, but he wanted to sort of probe Jan's life in a more complete way than just Jan as the sort of publisher.
What we found in our reporting was that they had agreed that Jan would not read the book at all until it was finished in its final form. Originally, the idea was going to be that he got the first, you know, hardcover book off the printing press. Ultimately, he saw one a little earlier than that. But how did we get to that agreement?
Well, there were a lot of negotiations, a lot of back and forth. In fact, it took a while for Jan to convince Joe to write the book. Obviously, Joe knew that there had been two failed biographies, and Jan wanted to sort of control what was in the book. This was as they were deciding whether Joe actually wanted to write it. But
it's an important point that Jan wanted Joe to write the book, as far as we know.
Yes. Jan wanted Joe to write it. Jan was impressed with Joe's writing. Joe had actually sent Jan some clips of his. But Jan, you know, wanted oversight over some of the, you know, sex stuff in the book. He wanted to be able to sign off on some of the more personal elements. And Joe said, no, I want to be able to write the book that I want to write.
And we saw a pretty extraordinary letter, actually, that Joe Hagan sent to Jan Wenner in the midst of these negotiations. I guess they had a meeting, and Jan said to him, you know, there's some personal stuff in here that I would like oversight over, specifically his when it comes to his sex life. And Joe made the point to him in, I thought, a pretty convincing fashion that either this thing was going to be totally unauthorized and thus people would take it seriously and it would mean something for his legacy, or it was going to be the sort of training wheels version with a invisible, you know, censoring hand over it. And I think it's pretty clear that we got the version that Joe Hagan wanted to write. And when eventually he agrees to these terms, he seems to have been on board throughout the whole reporting process. And the point that Joe made to us repeatedly was that Jan couldn't be surprised by what was in the book because he knew, because he was being told as it went along, and he was facilitating a lot of these interviews.
That's definitely what Joe told us, and he said, in fact, that Jan was so pleased in the beginning to, you know, have this biography written that he, you know, introduced Joe at one of Joe's first trips to WarnerMedia's offices as, this is my biographer, and they sat on the terrace of a hotel, and Jan said, one day there will be a plaque here. This is where this biography was written. At the same time, Joe was talking to all these people, and he and Jan wanted to know what they were saying. And Joe told us that he actually told Jan what people were saying about him. So Jan, definitely knew what the gist of the book was going to be, I think.
And I think you get a sense of Jan in this book as, the sort of ultimate insider, sort of fanboy turned pal of famous people. It's clear from the beginning that he was often letting his rock star heroes read the stories about them and sort of edit them along the way and, giving people special treatment a little bit, trading favors. But then that comes all back around, I think, because you see him facilitating these interviews for the book. As we talked about Mick Jagger's in here. Keith Richards gives some amazing quotes. Paul McCartney says, "I didn't like hanging out with Jan. We used to make fun of him." You have some Bob Dylan quotes that are arguably more revealing than most quotes that Bob Dylan gives. And Art Garfunkel, same thing. Jane, his longtime wife, now ex, who's obviously here for all of this. All of these people speak for the book, and all of them were approved to speak by Jan Wenner. And Joe Hagen said to us, that when he would come back and Jan would want to try to figure out what people said about him, and that Hagen was pretty honest with him and would sort of say, "Well, they told me this unflattering story about you," and that Jan would then sort of trade unflattering stories about that person. I mean, did that come through to you, Dwight, in the book?
Somewhat. I was going to say another thing, another reason I really admire this book is that clearly Joe sat through hours and hours of interviews. And you know what these kind of interviews are like. The person is going to praise Jan top to bottom for the first 45 minutes before they say anything interesting. And yet, you read the book, there's not a boring quote in it. I mean, clearly he has just gone for just the best stuff. There's almost no quote that just sits there and it's a space filler. And
even from the most A-list of people who are usually known for giving the most anodyne quotes.
Every quote is like a pie in the face or an arrow. And they're just fantastic. And it just took clearly a lot of work to do that and a lot of skill.
Why don't we listen to a little bit of relevant music from the time? We can play a little on the nose, but Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. So if you want to be more empathetic to Jan Wenner, you can see this book as maybe a little overbearing. There's a quote in our piece from John Landau, who was an early Rolling Stone employee, went on to manage Bruce Springsteen and is, probably best known in that capacity now, but was, also a longtime critic. And he says, that maybe Hagen opted to lean a little too hard on the gossip and especially the details of Jan's sex life. Now, Hagen, I think, would make the point that Jan's sex life was infused in the history of Rolling Stone and sort of inextricable from the story of the magazine. There's a really compelling part, I think, towards the beginning where he makes the point that Jan's sexuality, his life as a gay man, sort of allowed him to to see rock and to see the 60s in a beneficial way, which he could cast this light on the
stars
of the day.
You're right. There's great stuff about how young teenage boys secretly wanted to ogle these male rock stars.
Right.
You know, who knows how far the homoeroticism goes in terms of those 13-year-old boys, but Wender knew instinctively that people wanted to sit there and just gaze at their heroes, and he gave them to them in a way that was you could have in your house.
There was another review of the book from friend of the podcast, Rob Harvilla, on The Ringer. He called it a feast of exquisite sourness. he was very complimentary to the work that was done. And he says, to Hagen's credit, this book is never a hatchet job, but it is unremittingly harsh. Even the smallest details and throwaway asides rarely breaking in Wenner's favor. Did you take this book to be cruel at any point?
I didn't.
Was it too much for you?
It wasn't at all. I felt that Hagen was just doing his due diligence. I feel like he found great stories and he got them onto the page. I rarely, if ever, saw a line. I think I marked one line, and I can't remember now, that I thought maybe was just a little harsh from the writer's perspective.
Right.
But, I mean, that's one line. And I feel like he had such great material. I think just in telling it, you may perceive that it comes off as negative, but it's just a fact. And I do not get a sense this book is slanted in any way to be an anti-Wenner tract. As I said earlier in this podcast, to me, he comes off as kind of a great charmer in many, many, many ways. And I find him, you wish you knew him in the 60s and 70s. You really do. I mean, like a great person to be around. Even if he might stab you in the back 2 weeks later.
Right. And that's another through line of the book, is that there seems to be, you know, any person basically that he ever had a good relationship with, he then had a falling out
yeah.
with. And that goes, you know, from his earliest friends at school to John Lennon and Mick Jagger and Annie Leibovitz and, you know,
his son.
His own children. There is a lot of drugs and sex in this book. Like, I'm looking at a page right now that says that Jan was taking to cocaine like an Irish poet to rhyme.
Not a great line.
not a great line.
Not one of the
but I
lines.
Think, you know, telling in its sort of directness, you know, you get another quote from Tom Wolfe here that says of Jan that he never looks back. I don't know how he does it, but I think he's pretty much immune to guilt. You know, that I could see how that would sting.
Yeah, people compare him to sharks in this book, like more than once, I think. My favorite characterization is when Carolyn Kennedy, he was friends with the Kennedys. Yeah, I mean, Jan, one of the things this book talks about is that Wenner was a social climber from the word go, and he climbed very, very adeptly. Carolyn Kennedy talks about how much he loved to ski, and she calls him, I think, the Jimmy Buffett of winter. Which, you know, that's so evocative. I mean, who knew? Carolyn Kennedy, what a great line. Anyway, but everyone speaks the way of this book. It's like this is their best material.
It's true. You just can't even believe. I mean, I think maybe before we go, we'll do a little greatest hits rundown of some of our favorite moments and anecdotes. But while you mentioned the Kennedys, there was one where, I guess Jan in his cocaine phase had been with the Kennedys and comes back to the office and says, I bled all over Jackie, just like Jack, something like that, that's the kind of stuff in here that you just don't expect to hear about the rich and powerful, especially, I guess, while they're still alive.
Yeah, and you know, he hit on Carolyn Kennedy. And you know, Jackie Onassis wouldn't speak to him for 2 years. She was how old, I think, at the time? 17?
Yeah,
I remember. Quite young. Yeah.
There's some youth here. I wonder, Sydney, if you could talk about Jan's reaction to this as we learned, you know, not just that he's disappointed, but he's sort of flexing whatever leftover muscle he has as a media figure and as a publisher to sort of distance himself from this book.
Yeah, I mean, so Jan made a lot of friends in this business, and whether he was actually sort of, you know, pulling the strings or his friends were being loyal to him, when the book came out, there were a couple or a few events that were supposed to happen that are no longer happening. One of them is he was supposed to have a discussion at the 92nd Street Y with Joe Hagen. And as soon as the book came out, Joe's publisher called him and said, you know, Jan, the event is off. Jan doesn't want to do it.
He was essentially uninvited from his own panel.
Exactly. He was uninvited from his own panel. And I believe Joe was replaced with Alex Gibney, who shot a documentary about Rolling Stone that I think comes out next week. And it's a nice, flattering portrait of Rolling Stone.
That's a more generous portrait of the magazine,
definitely,
I would say, from what we've seen.
A nice companion piece to the book. There was also an event in San Francisco with Ben Fong Torres.
Right, yeah, this one didn't make our piece, but the early Rolling Stone writer and editor, Ben Fong Torres, who maybe our younger listeners remember from Almost Famous.
Crazy. That's just like 9 times. Crazy.
He was also scheduled to do a stop on Joe Hagan's book tour. He read the book. He told us that he felt like he learned a lot from it. He thought it was pretty well done. But then when he mentioned to Jan that he was going to do this, Jan said, I'd prefer if you didn't. And Ben Fong Torres said, you know, in deference to his friend of half a century, he opted to cancel the event.
Right. And then there was also supposed to be an event at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame where Jan is still the chairman. And that was also canceled, although I believe the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame said it was their decision and the book had not struck the tone that they were after as part of Rolling Stone's 50th anniversary
celebration. And yet, you know, some people have floated the notion that this is all just a PR stunt, that this is just a way to get the book in the news. And, you know, it worked to some degree. I personally don't think it was, but
you never know.
You never know. Yeah.
No, it's totally possible. I think, you know, you see that from the jump with Rolling Stone, and, you know, when he would almost get scooped on a story, there are a couple examples of him taking out full page ads in the New York Times that could come out before the story to say, you know, check out Rolling Stone in a week. We're going to blow your minds with this portrait of groupie culture. And, you know, he was always good at whipping up publicity for his own projects. And so it's, you know, either it depends on how you see it. It's a little maybe ironic that then he's getting this book out there more by moving himself far away from it. But yeah, you could also imagine a universe in which he thinks this is the best way to get people to read this.
As Joe
thing.
Says in the book, Joe Hagen says at the end of the book that he, in some ways, sees this as Winter's last great assignment, picking him to write the book. And, you know, if it's his last great assignment, Winter's going to flog it. So, you know, maybe he's, by anti-flogging, he's flogging. Who knows?
So I wonder what you guys think about this idea of legacy and sort of what this book does for Rolling Stone's legacy. Does it, and for Jan Winter, does it undermine it in making him this sort of mercurial, tyrannical, groupie, sort of all of these various negative descriptions that we hear of him throughout? Is that going to be the lasting image of him, or does this complicated portrait mean that he's more of a, you know, a Steve Jobs figure who, as we saw in his biography, could be horrible to people and yet, you know, is sort of venerated as this genius of his time and his era?
Well, I have a couple things to say about that. One, Hagen did Winter just a great favor in writing a book that was so fascinating. This book, I mean, I read biography. I read a lot of biographies. And this is pretty textbook biography. I mean, I would teach this book. And it could be that in 100 years, if we're all still here and the world isn't flooded and North Korea doesn't do whatever it wants to do, that this will be how people remember Jan Winter, because this great book was written about him. He's doing for Winter what Boswell did for Samuel Johnson. I mean, he just wrote this indelible portrait, I think, of just, not to say he's a great man, Winter, but he is irresistible. I mean, he's just wild, you know? And clearly he has problems, but thank God for those problems, because he managed to use his chameleonic nature, sleeping with men, sleeping with women, being interested in everything, to capture so many facets of his time. And he's such a paradigmatic figure of his time that I can see this book being taught. I mean, you know, normally the kind of biographies that get taught in academia are those of politicians or writers, you know, Ellman's biography of Joyce. It's rare that a pop biography comes along that has this much, I'll even use the word gravitas, in its own way. You know, I just think it's sort of masterful in many ways.
And as far as the magazine goes, Sydney, I know a lot of this book is focus on the 60s and then the 70s. You get a whole tour through the SNL years when Rolling Stone first moves to New York, and there's Lorne Michaels as sort of a confidant and friend and in some ways a foil to Jan. And then in terms of the present day, it's a little more truncated. You know, you're not getting a lot of the sort of Britney Spears years or the Kanye West years. You know, there's a little Us Weekly in here, which was, as you said, was another part of the Weiner media empire. But I wonder what you think this does for Rolling Stone's looming sale, and B, just for the legacy of the magazine as, you know, it potentially disappears from how we've thought of it for so many years.
I think that this is a good reminder of what Rolling Stone used to be. And I think that that's what a lot of people want to remember Rolling Stone as. I think that, yes, the last, you know, 10, 20 years maybe haven't been like its first 20 years, but people don't want to think about that aspect of Rolling Stone. They want to remember the 60s and 70s when John Lennon was on the cover and when, you know, the Rolling Stones were on the cover. And although the Rolling Stones maybe still are on the cover, but but they want to remember that time when this was sort of, you know, as my dad put it, he called it the Bible. And I think that this book does a really good job of making, you know, people who maybe didn't grow up in the 60s and 70s realize what their parents are saying when they call it the Bible. This book really, you know, not only did the magazine sort of, you know, talk about the culture, but it really defined it. So that I think is good for the magazine. It doesn't really give the last couple of years, I think, maybe what they're owed. But
you can write that book.
Yeah, sure. I'll write that book. It gives me my opening.
And as far as an audience for this book, Dwight, like, I know there's a lot of gold in here for boomers and boomer adjacent people. I think, you know, I think a lot of people could buy this book for the John Lennon stories and for the, you know, Mick Jagger stories. And I think there's stuff in here that you might not find even in all of the many, many books about those people. But do you think it translates to a more general reading audience who maybe isn't, you know, obsessed with these figures in the way that Rolling Stone's core readership was?
Yeah, I think it could be. I think he's just such a great character to have by the tail. You can just follow him, even if he could have been in another business almost. I mean, the music stuff, of course, is integral, but he's such an interesting character to follow. You can invest it in his life. I'd love for my kids to read it. I mean, I personally, you know, being someone who came out of alternative weeklies in that culture, I always loved stories about those old, you know, alt weekly magazines in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And there aren't a lot of great histories of those. You know, there's Abe Peck's book, but it's kind of different, doesn't really go very far. And this doesn't branch out in that way and talk about the scene a whole lot. You get Ramparts magazine in San Francisco in the 60s and some other things, but this is a pretty good look at alternative journalism in America in the 60s and 70s. And I would like my kids and other kids just to, maybe this is a good way to approach that period. It talks about a lot of the major political moments. You learn a lot about journalism, a lot about music. It's sort of, there's a lot of grist in this book. You know, just a lot of topics are picked up and talked about interestingly.
Something it reminded me of, and this is sort of a fringe character in the book, is the Hugh Hefner sections of Thy Neighbor's Wife, the Gay Talese book, which, you know, has this sort of Hugh Hefner profile / biography, especially from the early years, you know, baked into it. And just the level of detail and some of that, it brought me back to that. And I think also having Hef died recently, you know, he's somebody who I think was a little bit of an inspiration for Jan in terms of being an upstart publisher, and they sort of traded in these parallel worlds of sex and drugs and rock and roll.
There's a good comparison to Hefner. Hagen compares Winner and Hefner in the book, and he sees a lot of similarities, but he also points out that Hefner was famously willing to accept second-rate writing by first-rate writers, and that was almost just a line you always heard about Playboy. And Winner decided he wasn't going to do that. If he had a writer in his magazine, he wanted their best stuff, and he would find a way to pay them. I mean, often by, like, shorting the pay of his staff.
You know? Or literally giving them drugs, as we find out.
As a bonus. Yeah. There are great stories about how he did, quote, cocaine edits on certain stories. Just, he would just edit all night on coke and just rip things up. Anyway, just the stories just of his edits are extraordinary.
So maybe we do a little lightning round. I know, Dwight, you mentioned another sort of subplot of this book that is great, which is the Annie Leibovitz parts. She obviously sort of gave the magazine you know, its trademark look for a while there in the peak years. And she was a very close friend of the Wenners, both Jane and Jan, and has a few little affairs in here that are amazing.
Yeah, if you remember her, you know, early on in her career, one of her stylistic tics was always shooting people in bed. You know, she always got people. There was a famous Rolling Stone cover of David Cassidy, then a sort of, you know, the star of the Partridge Family, this teen, you know, the male Miley Cyrus at a certain point. And she gets
good,
him to
that's
go.
That's good. You're going to take our jobs.
She gets him to go essentially naked in the Rolling Stone, and he comes out as a bad boy, and she got that photograph. And after that, she used that leverage of photographing him to say to Peter Fonda, let's say, hey, David Cassidy got naked. Maybe you could get naked for me too. And there's a great moment later in the book in which they describe the photo editors at Rolling Stone going through her negatives and realizing that not only are the sort of subjects getting naked, but she's pretty clearly getting naked with them as well. And it talks about how she ends up sleeping with a lot of these people, and she sleeps with Mick Jagger, she sleeps with Wenner, she's doing tons of drugs, her drug dealer's dropping her off at the airport. I mean, just the stories. Where is our biography of Annie Leibovitz is what I want to know.
Yeah, hopefully that one's coming soon. But yeah, other sort of subplots or characters or just little anecdotes or gossip that stuck out to you guys, feel free. Sydney, was there
this is sort of jumping to the end of the book and sort of the present, but I was really struck by how Gus, Jan's 27-year-old son, is portrayed in the book. At one point, Alex, who is another one of Jan's sons, says, Gus is Jan, he's a mini Jan. And Gus is sort of taking control of his dad's empire. And it's kind of, you know, it's interesting to watch what he's done with it in terms of, you know, trying to push it more into the digital age and selling off a lot of, you know, the magazines. And another part that struck me is he actually gives some good interviews in the book. And when someone asks him, you know, is it weird to have to fire people? You know, the magazine industry has downsized a lot, and firing is sort of, you know, something that happens everywhere. He says, it was never, has never, won't ever be weird to me because I believe so much in the cause, and there's so much on the line between what the brand represents, myself and my family, the well-being of my family. And that really is how he talks. He talks like he's much older than he is. And when you're dissecting what he's saying, sometimes you come away thinking, like, that sounded really good, but I'm not sure if there was actually substance there.
Right, a little Jared Kushner-ish sometimes.
Yeah, there's some flashes of Jared in here in terms of aspiring media mogul.
Yeah. I think my favorite line, not my favorite, there's so many lines to love. But there's
so many lines.
At one point, they're doing drugs at a party, and someone says, well, if the drugs run out, we can always just suck on Hunter.
Yes.
Yeah, there's just so many lines like that.
And no shortage of Hunter S. Thompson stories in here, too. Karen, I think, my editor, was mentioning one where, you know, they all go to a party at, I guess, the publisher at the time, you know, someone who had been investing in the magazine, and Hunter S. Thompson arrives in the middle of the night and sort of doses them all and just watches the mayhem.
Yeah, he doesn't do it himself. Right. He's coldly watches. Oh, God.
There's a section where basically it talks about how Jan had turned down an offer to buy Rolling Stone, and I believe it was a $500 million offer, which is just unthinkable today. I mean, there are thoughts that, you know, this magazine it's going to fetch way less than $100 million now. And, you know, he doesn't do it. And he says, I suppose I could have lived without an occupation and been very, very wealthy. And what does that get you? It gets you a boat. I could be floating around on a boat. And basically he's saying, you know, I am Rolling Stone and I'm really nothing without Rolling Stone. And in the context of everything that's happened, it's sad in a way.
It is sad.
And there's, you know, I guess I'll sort of leave us with one bit where, you know, I think there are a few moments in the book that sort of presage Jan's own reaction to reading his book, where he sort of tells other people not to worry about the public perception of them. But there's one in particular where after Keith Richards' book comes out, My Life, which, you know, another pretty great memoir of this era of similar scenes, you know, and in that book, he's pretty relentlessly mean to Mick Jagger. And you have Jan here talking about how mad Mick was at Keith's book. And Jan says, I gave him a lot of advice on what to do, which is nothing. The more you respond, the more you make an issue of it. If you want to say anything, you say, well, this is as reliable as the memoirs of William Burroughs. But he was furious, 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 furious. And until Keith apologized, he refused to get the band back together for the last tour. And then you have a parenthetical here where Jan says of Keith Richards that he's an egomaniac and a nasty guy, by the way. So I think Jan could do to take a little bit of his own advice here.
Definitely.
To mark Rolling Stone's one-time import, you know, there is a song called The Cover of Rolling Stone by Dr. Hook. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Well, we're big rock singers. We got golden fingers. And we're loved everywhere we go.
That sounds like us.
We sing about beauty and we sing about truth at $10,000 a show.
Right.
We take all kind of pills that give us all kind of thrills. But the thrill we never know is the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times Popcast. You can subscribe to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/popcast. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, wherever you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado with help from Michael Cordero. And we'll be back next week.
Driving my limousine.
Now it's all designed to blow our minds, but our minds won't really be blown. Not the blow that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover.
Stone.